Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Prison Justice Show. A few weeks ago, we started talking about LGBT issues in prisons and then put a pause on it to have a few episodes about police brutality and protests. This week, we're going to go back to the topic of LGBT issues in prison. This isn't to say that my talk on police brutality and protests is completely over, but just so that we don't get too far ahead of this issue before we, jump back into it. As a quick refresher on what we had initially talked about, LGBT people, and especially transgendered people, were uniquely and negatively affected, by the criminal justice system. They're more prone to brutality and abuse, both legally and physically, during every part of the process, from being stopped by police to their hearings and sentencings to their times in jail. This is compounded with the general abuse that they face from society in general, which increasingly puts them at risk of contact with the criminal justice system in the first place. For some examples of those factors, you can look at the higher rates of bullying or mental health issues thereof, higher rates of homelessness, higher rates of poverty, higher rates of family rejection, etc. Basically, higher rates of everything that would destabilize their lives and put them in contact with a system that's meant to punish them for things that are basically out of their control. Last time we talked about this, we delved more into the numbers of the abuse that they face, kind of the statistics. And I think that we pretty definitively showed that there's a big discrepancy in abuse. Not that anyone deserves abuse, LGBT or not, but rather just to show that there's a bunch of unique additional harms that LGBT people have to face vis-a-vis the criminal justice system. So there's a big discrepancy in abuse just based on your sexual identity. So, with that quick recap, as a roadmap for today, remember that the last time, and I just said this, so sorry, but remember the last time we looked more at the numbers of the experience, some of the statistics, so to speak, but not really the story behind what they mean. This time, we're going to be delving more into the personal lives and stories of incarcerated or ex-incarcerated LGBT peoples, just to kind of see what this means for them, from a personal perspective, what actually happens to people. To begin with, we're going to look at a 2015 article by Erwin James called Coming Out, LGBT People Lift the Lid on Life in Prison. In it, he goes through the stories of multiple incarcerated LGBT individuals in the United Kingdom. So, not the US, but, it's a fairly prevalent attitude in general in prison justice systems or, prisons, jails, in general, this basically negative LGBT viewpoint. So, the first thing that I want to bring up is how the article notes the warped and contradictory views on LGBT people that are prevalent in prison. Many gay prisoners, for example, noted having sexual partners that were outwardly vehemently anti-gay and identified as straight to their loved ones, including wives and girlfriends outside of the prison, while obviously having gay partners of their own. Transgendered people found themselves complicatingly and confusingly being both the objects of derision and desire at the same time. They're basically hated as well as sought out for sexual interactions, consensual or otherwise. And there is also, obviously, the pressure for everybody to conform to an anti-LGBT mindset. Incarcerated straight people actually said that they felt a massive pressure to pretend to be anti-gay, even if they personally had no problem with the LGBT, in order to fit in with the rest. And this kind of has two impacts. The first one is the one on its face, the idea that if you are pressured into conforming to this anti-LGBT mindset, then you contribute to the anti-LGBT mindset in general, right? You basically reinforce the stereotype. But there's another thing that's, I think, pretty, I don't know if the word is sinister, but it might be a bit overlooked, is that even if you're pretending to be anti-LGBT, even if you're pretending to be this, just by pretending to do this, you yourself will internalize a lot of this mindset and these feelings yourself, even if you don't mean to. I mean, studies have shown this for a variety of things, from things as like as simple as pretending to be happy and smile actually does make people feel happier, to something like this. So the overall point I want to make here is that in addition to contributing to this general environment, when you have people who, otherwise have no hatred for LGBT people, when you have these people being forced to pretend that they do, they internalize this mindset. So you create hatred pretty much out of thin air. And another thing then going on from there is that LGBT people were made to be ashamed of their identity, you know, and they had to come to terms with their complex identities under the face of all this discrimination and abuse to begin with. Like, in the first place, coming to terms with your identity in a supportive environment is still difficult because you still have to, rectify your situation on the inside with, how you look and feel on the outside and how people tell you to look and feel on the outside. So basically, adding this factor into the mix doesn't make things any easier. So the article goes through the perspectives and stories. They're not super long, just a couple of paragraphs each, of multiple different people. So we're going to go through and reflect on a few of them. So to begin with, we're going to talk about Anthony. Anthony was an incarcerated gay person and said that his identity led to his involvement with the UK's justice system. Anthony recalled knowing his identity even from childhood, but repressing that part of himself, knowing even then, even as a child, that he would be ostracized for his identity. He noted that the group that he was a part of, called the Travelers, were especially discriminatory towards homosexual individuals, and said that because of that, he was, additionally cautious and feared being outed. When he finally did come out, he actually began to face several attempts on his life. He noted being knifed in the hand while he was trying to defend his face. He noted being stabbed. He noted being hit by cars and more. So Anthony's time in prison, when he was eventually, imprisoned as a result of all these different altercations, began with him trying to pass as straight. He said, "I have photos of my children on my cell wall. So why would anyone think differently? My partner visits me every week with his sister. My partner's family have accepted me as one of theirs, so much so that I see them as my own family now." But after a year, he said that his past caught up with him, so to speak. A fellow incarceree shouted a homophobic slur at him while he was walking back to his cell. Anthony noted feeling not frightened, but angry that someone had shouted this at him from afar, which he noted as them being too cowardly to say it to his face. In response to that situation, he actually decided to own his identity. He put on a rainbow wristband and, just kept it on since that day. This might not seem like a huge gesture, but he noted, and I think it's pretty obvious if anyone thinks about it, that this was pretty much a big deal. You're basically saying, "No, I am gay," in an environment that is very heavily weighted against being gay, that's very heavily weighted towards you facing abuse and everything. So for him, this was a pretty big step, and I think that most people can acknowledge that as such. He finished by saying, "A few people have raised their eyebrows, but no regular prisoner has challenged me seriously. I guess I can hold my own on the wing." In Anthony's story, we can see that he did not need to conform to the ideas of others in order to survive, even though initially he tried to. He credits having a strong support system, his partner and his family, with being able to survive as a gay man on the inside, even when he was trying to pass as straight. It's a common thread in many of the stories we see. Basically, having a strong support system makes it easier to bear the injustices and abuses inherent to current criminal justice systems. But for many LGBT individuals, as we talked about last time, the support system isn't present given the degree of alienation that many face from society in general. And furthermore, remember that last thing that Anthony said, right? He said, "I guess I can hold my own on the wing." That itself says that there is something that he basically has to fight against daily, right? Like, there's something for him to have to hold his own against. And that's a huge additional pressure that you need to face if you're an LGBT individual. Not only are you worried about just surviving, your life in general, but you're afraid about needing to hold your own, while you're in there. So with that said, the next story is that of Linda, a transgendered incarcerated person. So Linda recalled feeling the need to respond to abuse and discrimination with violence, either in response to violence towards her or as a way to put bullies in their place. She said that when she did come to blows with men who picked on her, she felt completely isolated, getting no support from other incarcerees, even LGBT ones, who she said were afraid that they would get bullied and attacked as well if they had tried to support her. To elaborate on their attitudes, she explained, "The majority of prisoners felt that gay, bisexual, or transgender people were sick, and as a result, you were constantly targeted just for being the way you are." The idea of LGBT people as sick is fairly common as well. Common but not good, obviously. The thought typically goes like this: If they're mentally ill, then something's wrong with them. If something is wrong with them, then they decide they deserve having something wrong done to them. And so goes the mind of the abusers. This also ties in with how society treats illness and mental illness in general. Think of how the mentally ill are often portrayed in media. You know, they're portrayed as scary or unstable and everything. And there's a strong negative stigma in general against those who, you know, go to therapy or those who want to go to get help. And even if you are someone who does get help or goes to therapy, there's a significant financial burden for those who do so. And so obviously this isn't to say that any of this is mental illness, but think of how people treat mental illness in general, and think of how abusers will say, oh, you're mentally ill, so I can do all this to you. And you can see how this forms some cohesive, if completely wrong, argument in the mind of an abuser. So Linda's story actually ends with a happy note, which is good. When she arrived at Park, the prison she was incarcerated at during the time this article was written, she noted that attitudes towards LGBT members were much better. She found LGBT support groups, support from officers, and healthcare to fit her situation. So basically, this is just to say that things aren't always dark, even if they often are. Linda said she now feels relaxed and happy, and having settled more into her gender, which is a good place to be. The last story from this article that we're going to go over is Daniel's, another gay incarcerated individual. His experience from the beginning was fraught with fear. I have spent a lot of my adult life inside, and although I am gay, I've never told anyone, he said. He recalls hearing others make homophobic jokes and slurs, but needing to stay silent when he had so much to say. I just wanted to get up on the roof and shout it out, but of course I didn't, because I was scared, he also continued. At one point, he recalls finally snapping, responding to a fellow incarceree who told him to, quote, admit it. Yeah, so what? What are you going to do about it? He responded. The person who asked the question was actually accepting of his situation, saying, no, we're still friends, I just wanted you to say it. But what Daniel found is that he was then subject to questions and derisive comments from others who were obviously less than accepting. After being outed, he noted how uncomfortable he felt in general, saying, if I started talking to anyone, I was afraid that they would think that I was coming on to them and make me feel a fool. Daniel eventually formed a relationship with a cellmate sometime after this situation, which lasted for about 18 months before his cellmate was moved to a different area. He noted being deeply upset about losing contact with this significant other, one of the few relationships that he'd had while on the inside, and I think the only one that he notes being romantic in this article. And he found that other than a few brief encounters after that, he never saw this person again. Daniel's story isn't particularly uncommon either. After all, living in fear of being outed, needing to pretend that you're straight, these are things that we saw in Anthony's case as well. Once Daniel was outed, though, he didn't have the same kind of support network that Anthony did in his partner and family, and, you know, extended family as well. So Daniel felt alienated from his peers, you know, when he felt too uncomfortable to talk to anyone, thinking that they would think he was coming onto them just because he interacted with them. And again, this isn't just a thing unique to the criminal justice system. LGBT people in general all have stories that go like this to some degree. But the difference is that when you're on the inside, there isn't usually anywhere safe to go. There isn't usually a community that'll take you in and accept you. Now, this isn't to say that it's easy for LGBT people on the outside to find these groups of people either, but it's still pretty obvious how stark of a difference in availability of such groups is. And even when Daniel finally found solace in a partner, he had no control over them being moved around, and he easily lost the one relationship that he had during his time in prison due to circumstances that he had no control over. And with that being the end of the personal stories from this article, I want to note something I think that's pretty important. So the thing with personal stories is that they're not usually flashy, entertaining, or extreme. You know, some are, but they usually aren't. You know, not everyone is driven to the brink of despair, and not everyone finds inner peace and solace. Not everyone is abused their entire time there, and not everyone makes it through without facing any negative environments. And that's important to remember when we look past the numbers and at the people behind them. You know, remember, it's about the prevailing system of oppression and darkness that people have to face, not just the worst instances that it showcases, although these are also obviously important. And what I mean is, take any of these stories and you see people putting up with maltreatment and discrimination that they never should have had to. You know, you see people facing feelings of fear and shame. It's a systemic problem that drapes the lives of many LGBT prisoners in a veil of gray. And the reality is that some can work through this veil and some cannot, but all are colored by it. And the other thing is, nobody should have to work through it in the first place. So finally, we'll talk about Gabriel Guzman, a gay ex-incarcerated individual whose story was originally published by Hannah Johnson in 2017. Guzman was a former Illinois prison inmate and is afflicted by many conditions, you know, physical and mental, due to the excessive use of solitary confinement as his punishment. So Guzman was actually in a, you know, a one-on-one interview with Johnson, and what she found is that he had a lot of difficulty even maintaining contact with others, and a lot of that is attributed to the fact that he spent 3.5 years in solitary out of his sentence of 10 years in total. And for these 3.5 years, a lot of the time was spent consecutively, so it wasn't just like, oh, 2 days in, 1 day out, you know, which is bad enough, but it was like months at a time that he was basically in complete isolation from others. He said that he was often sent to solitary confinement just for defending himself and other LGBT incarcerated peoples from abuse, you know, from both other inmates and prison staff. As we talked about last time, we talked about LGBT issues by the numbers. They face pretty much high amounts of abuse from, you know, both their former inmates and their prison staff. It's not just the inmates, and it's not just the staff, they face it from their entire environment. And in pretty startling numbers as well. So imagine this for a second, right? Imagine that you are spending 35% of your time, which is what Guzman did, completely alone and isolated from the world because you had bothered to stand up for yourself and others. A lot of the time we repeat the idea of standing up for others as a good thing, and it definitely is, but we don't talk too much about what the consequences of that are. And when you're in prison, these consequences are very real. You're spending this time, Guzman spent 35% of his time in solitary confinement because of that. He spent 35% of his time in a situation that's classified as torture by many human rights organizations. And the thing is that if you look at solitary confinement for LGBT individuals in general, the story gets worse. Of those that responded to a survey quoted in the article, you know, for those who had been in solitary, 38% said that they actually went to solitary for protection by their own request, whereas 50% said it was against their own will. That 38% number is pretty scary, right? 38% of those who went to solitary preferred the torture of solitary to the conditions that they faced outside in the general population. They preferred isolation and loneliness. You know, what does that say about how bad their conditions in general are? It means that their conditions are so bad that they not only encompass isolation and loneliness when they're with the general population, but they encompass a lot of other kinds of abuse and discrimination that these people don't have to face if they're willing to put themselves through a different kind of torture. So for Guzman, even if you look at his recreational habits, he said that he was driven to work out rigorously, not for fun, but so that he could avoid abuse. Like, one of the most popular prison activities for recreation is, you know, working out. It's one of the few things that's easily available to most prisoners. I won't say all, because I don't know the exact degree to which these things are available, but nevertheless, it's one of the few things that's actually available. But for Guzman, it wasn't like a, you know, for fun thing. It was basically a means to survive. Looking big and scary, after all, was one of the few ways that he could get others to stop the abuse in the first place. He said, quote, "I always had to be the strongest person in the area, and that was really taxing. Imagine working out not for fun, but as a means to survive. To not just have it be enough just to be strong or fit, but to need to be the strongest. Just to live your life the way that most straight incarcerees were able to. That's an immense physical and mental burden. It's basically a race for your own survival where if you slow down for a second, you're in danger." After Guzman's release, he spoke openly about his time in prison, noting that the mixture of both his Latino race and his sexual identity made his experience particularly difficult. Remember the last time we talked about the statistics of LGBT abuse? Latino individuals were in the racial group that faced the worst discrimination and abuse for their LGBT status, which is also reflected in the use of solitary confinement against them. At the time the article was written, a bill was introduced in December 2016 limiting the amount of time that, quote, state prison inmates could be placed in solitary confinement, unquote, with the bill's status pending. As of January 8th, 2019, I looked it up, and the bill actually died with Congress, the state Congress, having adjourned sine die on the bill. Basically means that they adjourned indefinitely, meaning they weren't going to talk about it again, which is basically how a bill dies in this case. So, unfortunately, that story doesn't end with too much of a high note there, but I think that it's good to be realistic about these kinds of things. A lot of the time you'll actually hear me say, oh, there's some bill that was introduced right now and they're talking about it, or it's pending, or they're voting on it, you know, something like that. But that doesn't mean that just because this kind of bill is introduced to help out, you know, incarcerated individuals, and then in this case it also help LGBT incarcerated individuals as an extra measure, because they're the ones that face most solitary confinement because of their identity. So even when you have bills like this that are proposed or whatever, and people think, oh good, the fight is pretty much over, it's like there's still a very high chance that they don't go through, because the kind of conditions that LGBT people face in general are made by the kind of people that make laws in general too, right? It's not like these conditions came out of nowhere. So anyways, with that having been said, today we went through the personal stories of multiple LGBT individuals. It's important to look at the people behind the numbers that we talked about, you know, look at the lived experiences as they were. Numbers can tell you some of the story, but they don't tell you what it feels like to be one of these individuals. They don't key you in on the intricacies, you know, the little pressures, the little fears that drive people to feel excluded, you know, because, well, they are excluded, and which affects their well-being in general. Remember when we talked about those stories from that first article, most of the people who were in that article didn't talk about some huge event, you know, they didn't talk about some big abuse that they faced on one day, or even some big abuse that they repeatedly faced. A lot of the time it was like bullying, it was people coming up to you and basically shouting discriminatory things, you know, it wasn't like everyone beat you up and, you know, and abuse you together or something like that. It's a lot of these little things, these little pressures, little fears, like I said, that actually affect how you feel, and that's what the lived experience is going to look like. So, with that having been said, that'll be our show for today. As always, thank you for listening. You can send any comments, questions, or concerns to prisonjusticeshow@gmail.com. Next time, we're probably going to talk more about protests and fighting back against police brutality, you know, that vein of things. But until that time,